This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. About this time 5 years ago, the world as we knew it was closing down. Today, the lingering discomfort some feel over the handling of COVID-19 pandemic has led to the broader concerns in once routine healthcare.
A casualty of that has been a loss of trust in childhood disease immunizations, such as the Tdap, measles, mumps, rubella, polio.
That story and more coming up this West Virginia Morning. Support for West Virginia Morning is proudly provided by Hope Gas, committed to the growth and development of West Virginia to strengthen the community. Information at wvisforhope.com. A bill to bring data centers to West Virginia also has provisions that could result in higher electricity rates. Curtis Tate has more.
House Bill 2014 was introduced Tuesday and immediately backed by Governor Patrick Morrisey. Its main purpose is to enable microgrids in the state that could power data centers, which are currently concentrated in other regions of the country. The bill also contains three provisions affecting coal-burning power plants in the state. First, it requires the plants to be ready to operate at a 69% capacity factor. Currently, none of them reaches that threshold, running closer to the average of 40% in the PJM regional grid, which includes West Virginia. Second, it requires coal-burning power plants to maintain a 45-day supply of coal at each plant, up from 30 days. Appalachian Power has told state leaders that it would not be economical to operate the coal plants at the higher capacity factor because they have a hard time competing with natural gas. Operating at 69% could have raised costs for customers by $240 million over the past 18 months, the company said in a presentation to the State Public Energy Authority. Emmett Pepper, policy director for Energy Efficient West Virginia, says Morrisey didn't present those parts of the bill.
There are multiple giveaways to coal-fired generation, and some of them are on the backs of West Virginia ratepayers.
The bill also appears to make it more difficult for Mon Power to proceed with its plan to replace two coal plants in the state in the next several years with combined cycle natural gas plants. West Virginia Public Broadcasting reached out to Appalachian Power and Mon Power for comment on the legislation. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston.
West Virginia's eastern panhandle is hours from Charleston, but decisions made at the state capitol still reach the state's easternmost region, one of the few areas in the state that is growing in population. As part of our daily broadcast, the legislature today, Eastern Panhandle reporter Jack Walker spoke with delegates Michael Height and Mike Hornby, both Republicans from Berkeley County. They discuss lawmakers' approach to regional issues like infrastructure constraints and a higher cost of living.
Delegates, thank you both very much for being here today. So as a bit of an introduction for our audience members who might be unfamiliar, I am West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Eastern Panhandle reporter, which is both your neck of the woods as well. So we're here today to discuss some issues affecting the Eastern Panhandle region, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. So just to jump right in, one major issue that a lot of residents bring up is just the rate of development locally. So unlike a lot of regions of the state, West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle is experiencing population growth, new residents, new businesses. I'm wondering, is that something that you've seen come up at all so far during this year's legislative session? I know it being different, is it hard to elevate that issue to kind of a state level discussion, or has it come up so far in this year's session to your knowledge?
So I think we're in a really unique position in the Eastern Panhandle where we're growing way faster than the rest of the state. And the state doesn't see our problems as being problems. So trying to convince other legislators that we have problems with growth is extremely hard. But I think we're building bridges to have those conversations.
Got it. And was there anything you wanted to add?
And one of the bigger things that we have problems with, one of our bigger problems is the infrastructure. Our infrastructure wasn't built for the growth that we're seeing right now. So we're sort of playing catch up and trying to, convince legislators and the rest of the state that we need infrastructure dollars in that area. It can be difficult sometimes.
And when it comes to roads, you're planning those roads 6 to 10 years out. And even though the new governor is from the Eastern Panhandle, we're finding that a lot of those projects have already been decided. So we're always behind when it comes to roads. And it's one of those things that's very difficult to address in one session.
Absolutely. And how do you, I guess, you mentioned it's a difficult conversation to have. How do you begin having those sort of talks with other lawmakers? Are they able to see, you know, benefit in improving the infrastructure or conditions in one region?
Well, I think one thing that Mike brought up earlier is building bridges, and we've tried to do that. You have to understand what the problems of other areas in the state are and have empathy for them and talk to them about their problems and vote for things that don't affect the panhandle at all to help those areas. And then in so doing, you get those individuals to see your side of the story as well. So it's a lot about building bridges.
I think the biggest thing for all the Eastern Panhandle delegates, and I would say all of the folks back in the Eastern Panhandle, is locality pay. The reality of that situation is we don't have the votes yet. We are trying to get there, but trying to convince somebody that my teachers are worth more than your teachers is a very difficult conversation to have, especially if they can't see the fact that houses in the Eastern Panhandle almost double the price of those in the South. We are competing with some of the richest counties in the United States for jobs. You can drive across our borders and make a lot more money. So while that's a reality for the Eastern Panhandle, it's something that we have to discuss, but we have to work twice as hard to get those issues addressed.
Yeah, and just to provide a little context for our viewers, our listeners, is locality pay is referring to, you know, increasing the pay for a lot of different public positions in areas that are higher cost, so regions like the Eastern Panhandle. So I know I have a couple written down, which is, you know, Senate Bill 506 would create, like you mentioned, Delegate, for teachers, it would create a regional-based pay bump for higher cost areas. I know, Delegate, you've also put forth a bill that would apply to police and county boards of education. So you mentioned that, you know, there are difficulties in getting other regions to see it as important. It seems like you're, you know, leveraging teachers in a certain area. I guess it's an issue that's come up many different sessions so far. Is it something that you see as a realistic outcome for this session, or is it something that is going to require a little more groundwork?
I think it's going to require a lot more groundwork. I think if we're going by what we discuss privately, we're still short on the votes. And we need to address this from a different perspective where it's not a, and I agree with the governor on this, it's not a locality pay issue. It's more of a backyard brawl. Let's lift all ships so that we can get better pay for everybody.
That was Delegates Michael Height and Mike Hornby speaking with Eastern Panhandle reporter Jack Walker about the issues facing their district. Visit our website to hear the rest of that interview and make sure to tune in for our daily broadcast of the legislature today at 6 p.m. on TV and radio, and then again on the West Virginia Channel at 7 p.m. It's also streaming on our website and YouTube channel. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. Mostly sunny today. Gusty wind and dry conditions will create favorable conditions for the rapid spread of wildfires today. Highs in the 70s and 80s. Increasing cloudiness and gusty wind tonight with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, rain and gusty wind. Highs in the 50s and 60s. Support for WVPB is provided by Hope Gas, serving West Virginia's communities with grants and volunteerism through their WV is for Hope program. Online at WVisForHope.com. Five years after most of us started using words like quarantine in our daily routines, questions remain about the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and who needs the vaccines today. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's health reporter Emily Rice spoke with Dr. Stephen Eschenauer, public health officer of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, about COVID-19's lasting impact in West Virginia.
If you could just tell me, you know, what capacity you were in, were you still in the same, were you at the health department?
So as a physician, when COVID started, I was the director of the emergency department at Jackson General Hospital in Ripley, West Virginia. And it proved to be a very busy and tumultuous time, being the ground zero of a pandemic. So that as we were learning on, one, how to protect our staff and ourselves, two, how to take care of patients with a relatively new disease, we had seen other coronavirus family, but not the COVID-19 variant before. And it was very highly virulent, very contagious, and caused a significant strain, not just on the emergency department, but the entire healthcare system in the state.
If you could kind of speak to the vaccine development and how much people were looking forward to it, and then when that sentiment toward medical workers that we are seeing play out in our lawmaking chambers, you know, when did that sentiment come about?
I can't say exactly when the sentiment changed, but it appeared to change when restrictions started to come about, reference masking, work restrictions, school restrictions, et cetera, that led people to want to push back. I think that the mandates for immunizations also caused a significant amount of pushback in those who did not want the immunization.
Let's talk about where we are with COVID now, because you kind of speak to COVID becoming a part of our routine. In the health community, when did that sentiment, that feeling, that approach start to change?
That was likely in 2023 is when we really started to see the reporting get downgraded from an immediate reportable to a 72-hour reportable. And we started to see the strains of COVID be still highly infectious or contagious, that is from person to person, but not as virulent, meaning that it doesn't make you as sick, kind of similar to some of the other coronavirus strains that were already in our communities. So I think that really started to turn the corner in 2023. Today, yes, we are still battling COVID. We see a number of outbreaks, particularly in long-term care facilities where you have patients that are at particular risk, one, due to weakened immune system, but also you have a large number of people living in close proximity to each other. Immunizations have also changed because as the strains have changed, similar to influenza, we see different strains each season. We also see a similar pattern with COVID. So it's more likely that we will need a immunization for COVID each year to cover the current strain.
Could you talk about, you know, the medication and treatment that there is, and why is it important to still take COVID seriously?
Certain individuals are at much greater risk due to a COVID infection than others, and those include individuals that are older, that is our geriatric population. The older we are, we found that the COVID virus was much harder on the elderly. The other group are those that are morbidly obese. For whatever reason, COVID was particularly hard on those with obesity. And of course, anyone with an immune disorder is at risk of almost any disease because they just don't have enough ability to fight it off. So if individuals are significantly symptomatic and or at high risk, it is important to seek care from your physician. And as far as treatment, we still have the medication Paxlovid available. Unfortunately, Paxlovid has quite the number of medication interactions and may not be taken by everyone, but that needs to be discussed on an individual basis with a provider who is experienced with the medication.
How did the COVID pandemic prep West Virginia state officials for any possible future outbreak?
The preparation that came about from being able to not just figure out and practice, but to pull off mass immunization events, many of the counties became very honed and very good at this. That was one element. Another element is our ability to contact trace individuals that had exposure is probably as good as it has ever been, because all the counties became very good at the local health departments working with the hospitals and other agencies worked very diligently to contact trace and notify people of exposure. And then, of course, mass testing events. As you recall, during COVID, we were able to pull off some significantly large testing events for the general public, probably never been done before. So these were all elements that help protect public health and our population by addressing testing, immunization, as well as contact tracing. There's one really important thing that I want to stress, and that is that during COVID, we saw a number of individuals lose trust in public health and in their providers. And a casualty of that has been a loss of trust in childhood disease immunizations, such as the Tdap for tetanus and pertussis, that is whooping cough, measles, mumps, rubella, polio. People were lumping COVID with traditional childhood vaccines that have been around for decades, that have been proven through hundreds of millions of doses given to be both safe and effective. Look at West Virginia. We've not had a case of polio since 1970. You can argue all you want about the immunization, but the fact remains, we've not had a case of polio since 1970. And that is attributable to one thing, and that was a vaccine that worked. We have been extremely fortunate in not having measles outbreaks, which are going on now in approximately a dozen states. We have one of the best immunization laws and highest immunization rates for childhood diseases in the country. Those laws don't cover COVID. They only cover our routine childhood immunization.
That was Dr. Stephen Eschenauer, a public health officer of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department, speaking with health reporter Emily Rice about the fifth anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic. This is West Virginia Morning. It's a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org.